Welcome back to the show, you beautiful animals. Today, I would like to introduce to you the amazing Millie Rose Bannister. From lifestyle journalism in Silicon Valley to youth mental health charity founder, Millie is a well-known face in the online world of well-being. Her charity, Allkind, is Australia's first digital peer-to-peer mental health first aid training for young people, and she runs mental health campaigns to raise awareness and reduce stigma. Millie is a really purpose-driven creative director and speaker, passionate about using stories to foster connection and help make meaning from her life. I'm really excited because in today's episode, I'm talking to a charity founder, which can be a lonely road at times. And I think we cover some of that in a really meaningful, constructive way. And we also go deep into what her truth is, what her core values are, and also the things she does to prevent and maintain a sense of mental health. One discussion I found, selfishly very interesting is how do we create the altitude where mental health is a topic that's not rigidly silent and shut down, like potentially happens in older generations, or what I believe is happening, an overcompensation of mental health in younger generations at times where we're almost desensitizing the message and in some ways tokenistically giving mental health labels to drive attention or identity. Now, of course, I don't mean that for all people by any means, and this is coming from a guy that has experienced extreme mental illness since a young age and is a huge proponent, in fact, devoting my life to getting people to speak up and seek help. And with Millie working with so many young people, I asked her some of those questions on how we can find that middle ground in regard to stigma and the level of conversation we're having so that it's productive and genuine. So without further ado, introducing to you, Millie Bannister. Well, one thing I appreciate about you, Millie, is that you lean into authenticity. Like, there's a lot of people in this space that kind of toe a mental health line.
Yeah.
And they're like, everything's fine. And like, da 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 da. But you keep it very real. And I think you're speaking to a demographic that needs our help the most, like young people. So, what are the top two values in your life that you live by?
That's a nice question to start with. I would probably place family pretty high up on my value list, mainly because they are making up the majority of my support network. And I think when you get to that point of preventatively or proactively looking after your mental well-being, you are identifying not just who's closest to you, but who can back you when you need it most, and also who is good at it as well, because not everyone has the capacity to support you, and that's fine. It might not always be that way. People go through things themselves, so you can't always expect the same people to back you, but I would probably argue that if you have a really strong connection with your family members, I'd say that they know you the best as well, and I'm privileged in the fact that I feel connected and supported by my family, because that's not always the case either, but that's why I would place family at the top of my values list. Second to that would probably be freedom. I'm a Sagittarius, if that is relevant to anyone. I don't know a lot about star signs, but I do know that it means that I really value freedom, not just location wise as in travel, but in my location freedom of where I work every day, being able to choose whether or not I go to the office at a specific time, or I stay home, or I work from a cafe. Financial freedom as well is something that I'm constantly aiming for, and also location freedom. I honestly personally can't think of anything worse than being tied to one specific desk 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. That really sends me into discomfort for a number of reasons, but mostly because I value freedom so, so much. So all of those things combine into what that value looks like for me.
Yeah, freedom is such a potent word. I feel like it's supercharged in that it evokes such a expansive energy, at least when I think about it. And I mean, the opposite to that is discomfort and trapped. Do you remember a time in your childhood where you felt trapped?
Nothing specific comes to mind, although speaking back to the way I live my life now in terms of what I do for a career and the way I shape my lifestyle, I do remember, and I brought this up with my mum the other day when I was visiting her in Brisbane, I was in the car park with her loading groceries, and I was in the middle of a 3-month stint working for Kmart as a 15, 16 year old, and I absolutely hated it for so many reasons, but I had a really awful boss, and we had some challenges around me requesting time off for my mum's birthday, and it just became this whole thing, and I just hated how or the lack of control that I had over a situation like that. And I remember saying to my mum as we were loading the groceries, I don't know how I'm going to work as an adult for a company or for a person that doesn't let me do the things that matter to me. Like, again, that came back to my top value of wanting to be there and spend time with my family on my mum's birthday, but they wouldn't let me. And I had such a visceral response to that, to the point where I was like, I don't know how I'm going to adult, because if I can't work for someone, how am I supposed to earn money? Yeah. And of course, mum's thinking was along the same lines. Well, unfortunately, Millie, that is the way the world works. You're going to have to work. And I was in tears. I was 15 or 16 crying about working at Kmart. Like, it just, on the outside looking in, it's hilarious. And, you know, my mum kind of had that really surface level response as well. Totally fair. But for me, it was so much deeper than that because I felt so trapped.
Yeah. So independence is kind of coexisting with freedom for you. And it's already been a couple of times since we started talking that you've mentioned your mum, and I can relate to that as someone who looks at my mum as the reason I'm still alive, as a support system. At what age did she start supporting you with your own like mental health issues?
I think she's been ever present in my mental health journey. I don't think she's always been, you know, the very best support for me. I think a lot of the time I went to my friends, which is something I'm sure we'll touch on later in the episode. I mean, that's pretty common, but I think her and I might have different ways of looking at mental illness, probably because we don't experience mental illness the same. And that's very normal as well, not just for family, but for friends. And even in the therapy space, often it's hard to relate to a patient or to a therapist, because at the end of the day, lived experience is the only way that we can feel what it's like to be in someone else's head. But she's always just been, as I said, ever present, and someone that was never not there for me. And she's done the best she could as well.
So do you think that throughout the shortcomings that any parent has, the thing that has helped you the most is her presence? And I'm assuming that means emotional presence, not just physical presence. The willingness to feel with you.
An interesting side note on that, something that I really resonated with was I was watching one of Brené Brown's she has some new videos on some streaming platform, but she was talking about how parents often like to go into their child's dark room where they're kind of moping or grieving or, you know, avoiding, and they want to go in and they want to turn the light on immediately. But she was saying that the better thing to do is to go in and sit with your child in the dark and teach them how to feel their feelings and go through those emotions and process them. And then you can turn the light on and you can face things together. And that's something my mum has always done for me. She's kind of had or held space for me to, you know, grieve and avoid, but she's also then backed it up with the action step. It's not just like, okay, I just want to be heard and I want to just, you know, sulk and grieve. I also want some ideas around how I can feel better, which usually requires some form of action. And she's been really good at holding space for both.
Yeah, the parents empowering children to feel their feelings, not just solve the problem, is so key, because there's no amount of problem solving that can outrun a feeling, in my experience.
Yeah.
So you just got to get really fucking good at processing them.
Yeah.
Now talk to me about your feelings. when did you start to experience mental health issues?
Honestly, probably in hindsight, since I was a kid, I'd say. I think you'd probably label me as a worrier, a kid who was always kind of a little anxious. But that really manifested in high school when the pressure started coming in terms of academic. I was involved in a bunch of co-curricular sports and arts and things like that, friendship circles and how they manifested, and, you know, boyfriends and things like that. Kind of it all piles on and the pressure builds and you start to kind of face that feeling of overwhelm. And so my anxiety really manifested then. Whenever I present a pitch or a brand narrative around the charity that I started, which focuses on peer-to-peer mental health support, I always touch on my kind of first experience with anxiety and depression. At the time, I was supporting my closest friend through a very, very dark period when they lost their sibling. And I was that person that they went to for that kind of emotional support for a variety of reasons. But I then took on this enormous kind of mental load and emotional load that really felt quite suffocating. And so the anxiety built. It was probably already there, but there was a lot of manifestation of symptoms around anxiety, and it was probably the first time that I noticed the experience of depression as well. I experienced both hereditary and situational depression. I think most of us will experience situational depression at some point in our lives. COVID was a great example of that, of what that felt like. But hereditarily, it means that even when you're in a peak of your life, you can also be experiencing the manifestation of depression. And so I live with both of those conditions. I'm medicated, I'm stable and neutral, and it's brought me up to this baseline where I can then strive to turn my lifestyle factors into well-being in moments of happiness and well-being, whereas if you don't have that baseline kind of balance and you are experiencing mental health disorders without any form of support, it's so much harder to reach those highs.
100% agree. As someone who also unfortunately happens to know what it's like to be anxious and depressed, having a baseline to stand on is a bit of a privilege. Like I always say to people, if you have peace, you have everything. Because there would be a million times in my life when I was not okay that I would think to myself, I would trade every single thing I have right now to exhale. Just to sit there, drink a coffee, stare at something and go, like everything.
Yeah.
I didn't need anything except that exhale. And it felt a million miles away.
Mm.
And now that there's a platform to stand on and then some, I'm like, holy fuck, this is all one big bonus.
Right.
Can you take me back to a moment where you felt like peace was out of reach? Like a memory that has really stuck with you of being like, fuck, I'm at an all-time low.
Yeah. I would say apart from that experience that I've just spoken about when I was in high school around 16, my first experience with mental illness, it actually wasn't too long ago. It was during COVID. It was 2021. I was living near my parents with my partner at the time, and we were going in and out of lockdowns, and I was unhappy in the relationship. I was unhappy with where I lived. There were so many lifestyle factors that were far from ideal, although I was safe. My hierarchy of needs was mostly met. But there was that second half that made me feel trapped, I guess. And I wasn't living in line with my values. And so I also chose that time to see if I could come off the medication that I'd been on for 10 years. I can't really remember why. I just kind of wanted, I guess, to see, yeah, how I felt without them and wean myself off with the advice of a doctor. And I felt fine. I was also facing a lot of fatigue, so I was trying to experiment with different changes to see what could work for me. And it did for a couple months. My fatigue lifted a little bit. But then I kind of hit this wall and I went downhill really, really quickly. And within a couple of weeks after that, I was on the floor of my bathroom calling Lifeline. I had nothing left and nobody knew. I think also at that time, it felt like there were a lot of conversations about mental health, but there was also a lot of suffering comparison as well. And I was safe. I was in a state where we weren't locked down. I had kept my job. I had my parents around the corner. I was in a relationship. All of these things, I think that gets in your head as well when you're feeling really hopeless, even though you have nothing left. As I guess a people pleaser, I still had this part of me that was like, I'm not suffering enough. Like, I don't deserve support right now because there's obviously something broken in me that nobody will understand. My parents love me so much. I have amazing friends that I can call at any minute of any day, but it's also what it feels like in that moment is an admission of defeat as well. I think especially during that time, because everyone's rallying together going, we have to get through this. And I couldn't get through it. And I don't think it was even COVID related. I think it was just lifestyle related because of all of the things that were going on. So yeah, I often look back at that time and I kind of have, you know, it's been 2.5 years now since that moment. And I can remember it so viscerally because it felt so painful. But it's also a marker in time, I guess, and a reminder every year from that date where I can look back at the difference in myself. I think you've also got to be careful with comparing yourself at your very, very most lowest to where you are now, because you can end up back there. You can always end up back there. But I think there's a number of things that I've learnt from how that situation came about that I would take with me and use to not let myself get back into that situation.
Tell me three of those learnings.
I would say not compromising on your values. Obviously, the freedom thing came into it with COVID. I also wasn't with the right partner and I knew that, and that was a contributor to my mental unwellness. And I've been single since because I'm too scared to end up in that headspace. Great person, great human, just not for me. And I knew that. And that's very hard for me to sit with in my gut. My gut feelings are extremely loud and disruptive and they manifest physically. And that contributed greatly to my unwellness. The other thing I think would be how much exercise has changed my life since then. It doesn't even have to be labeled exercise, just movement in general. Since then I've started running, I've gone back to yoga, I've gone back to ballet.
Fuck yeah.
I've started playing tennis. Honestly, anything that brings me joy. It's taken a little while, but I think moving my body in more enjoyable ways has meant that my mind-body connection has been a lot stronger, and I've kind of, I guess, stopped dissociating and separating myself from who I am physically on this earth and who I am spiritually and emotionally and mentally, and connected the two and just become a lot more grounded and happier in who I am, literally.
Grounding into who you are is fucking powerful. To relate to that, I spent most of my life dissociating from who I was, including my body, because I wanted to be anywhere but me, in myself, in my own head. And I do agree that it's scary to know that we can go back there. It's also awesome to know that there are some things that come out of those deep dark holes that no one can ever take away from you. And I do believe that you can fall back into that hole, but I don't think you can ever go as deep if you integrate those experiences in the right way with the right learnings and the right tools. Because once you're down there, you're like, oh, yep, motherfuckers, I know you. Like, I know these crevices. I know where not to step. And I think people like you inspire me because you go to pay it forward, you know, and you devote your life to this. Particularly something I'm envious of, which I don't do enough of, I want to do more of, is working with young people. And Lord knows we need it now more than ever. I want to talk to you about young people in a way that feels maybe negative, but I don't want it to be negative. I want to shift my perception on it. But part of me thinks that our generation, you're probably younger than me, you look more youthful than me, but I'm just going to say our, hoping that I look as good as you for whatever age you are. But there's the generation above that is rigid and shut down to a mental health message. I think our generation is doing a good job at finding a middle ground. We're not there yet. But the younger generation, I feel for, because they're the loneliest generation, most competitive because of the social media experience, and that place can be a toxic rabbit hole. But I do see a trend where mental health is being used as a bit of a badge of honor and attention seeking. And whenever I hear words on Instagram like mentee be, mental breakdown, or I'm so triggered, and I'm like, I'm so OCD, and I'm like, I've almost gone into a psychosis because of OCD, and it's not a mentee be, and it's not triggered, it is, I want to blow my brains out. So what do we do to help inspire a generation that is lonely? And I, by no means am I discounting that there's a ton of people in the younger generation that is genuinely hurting, but not to the point where we trivialize it as something to give us a sense of identity.
I think it's our fault, honestly. I think, I don't think we're providing enough educational opportunities that are integrated or mandatory or engaging. I think as someone who quite possibly used to throw around those words, now is much more careful because I have the education, and with education comes understanding and compassion. So for example, using the word OCD to describe yourself being overly clean is something that I've definitely done in the past, but now learning about the condition is something that I would never do again. And I genuinely believe that majority of Gen Z or that demographic, having had that education, would also agree with that behavioral choice or improvement. I don't think we're giving them enough language and framework to accurately describe their conditions and their mental illness and the way that they're struggling. I think if they had the right language, it might not appear so much, and it wouldn't be so flippantly used. That may be because that's basically my entire mission with the charity that I run is to simply educate young people to be able to support their mates safely. And a byproduct of that is cultivating compassion, because the more you know about mental health conditions, the more careful you're going to be about upsetting people with those conditions, because you know how hard they can be to live with. It's a tricky one. I think they are potentially the most compassionate generation. I really love working with them. We have a youth board of advisors, we call them, and we kind of bring monthly themes to them, say, for example, Pride Month, and we bring these themes to them as individuals. There's about 10 of them from around Australia who have different lenses and experiences through which they apply our prompts, and they bring this real world or real time on the ground touch point from the demographic we're aiming to serve. And they bring with them their current struggles, what their friends are talking about at school or at work, what they've seen on social media on their feeds. And that is really helpful, because it's different. I really do think it's different. Technically, I'm on the border of Gen Z and millennial, but I definitely feel a lot more aligned with millennial Gen than I do with Gen Z. I think because I was lucky enough to miss that high school experience where we were on social media. I think at the very most we might have had Facebook and Messenger or something, but I think our brains are wired a little differently. So I think, to answer your question, I really do feel like it's a lack of education. Because the ones, or most of the people who are using these phrases, are probably trying to connect with other people in the mental health community, or trying to start conversations, whether they know it or not, around mental health, because they probably want to feel less alone. But again, I don't think they have the right framework or language to be able to do it appropriately.
Given that you have such incredible access to kind of ears on the ground, what do you think are the three main issues facing young people at the moment that's hurting their mental health?
I would happily tie all of those three issues into screen time addiction. Yeah, I think it has completely infiltrated the way our brains are developing and facilitate the way that we make choices and live our lives every single day. I don't think many of us are immune to screen time addiction. I think even most of us who are quite cognizant of the amount of time we're spending looking at screens are still somewhat addicted to using our phones and our laptops and social media and the tech that comes with it.
They wouldn't say that. Like, if you were to ask, hey, group of young people, what's your biggest problem? They wouldn't say, I'm addicted to screens. Would they?
No, I don't think many of us
would. It's the implications of that.
Exactly. It's the cause and effect. And the implications of screen time addiction is the overconsumption of information. It's the overwhelm. It's the time spent on social media. It's all just feeding back into, the dopamine addiction as well, and the way our brains operate. And it's simply all far too much information to try and comprehend. And it's not our fault. It's not their fault. It's not at all. We know for a fact that not just our apps like Instagram, but our phones, the way notifications show up, all of that has been built with borrowing from behavioral psychology. It's not our fault. It was designed to keep us addicted. And so it's kind of this never-ending loop. It's like, yeah, we can be aware of it. We can be self-aware. We can set our boundaries, and we can, you know, do self-care and all of these kind of really surface-level ideas around how we manage our relationship with the internet. But at the end of the day, even sitting here as two people who do this for a living and hear stories every day and have access to experts, we're not immune either.
Mm.
I often throw around the excuse that, oh, well, it's my job. I'm tied to the internet. I have to show up. I have to be there. I have to run this organization. But there's so much time during the week where I just really unconsciously open my phone and scroll and interact. I even get into that freeze state where I'm immobilized, where I'm just completely overwhelmed. It's potentially a stress response to the overconsumption of information. I'm just frozen and I'm like, I need to get off, but I actually can't. I'm not sure what's wrong with me. And
doom
I would
scrolling.
Argue, yep, I would argue that's a really, really common experience.
It is. And, you know, I go to, if that is what's happening, where trying to escape into a dopamine hit. And then, yes, it's like that by design. I wonder what we're running from. Like, is it just that we didn't have something that was so easy to run toward before? Like, you know, the distraction and escapism wasn't available in your pocket at all points in time. And you had to physically go out and like go to a park or go to a bar in order to be stimulated. And now it's all around us.
Mm.
Or are we in a lost generation that needs to run from something more? Maybe it's a mixture of both.
Yeah. Mm. I think it is a mix of both. I think it's a mixture of we're being pulled towards something very, very strongly, not just with that behavioral psychology and the decisions around how apps show up on your phone and how they keep you on there, and the FOMO that it creates when you're off. Like, how many times do you get a notification and you just really, really feel this strong need to go and check what it is?
Mm.
But I also think it's the running from as well. I think when I was younger, and I've chatted about this with my therapist really recently, because she and I were touching on the fact that I find it really hard to sit still and I'm extremely avoidant of boredom.
Mm.
I have always been avoidant of boredom, and I've tried to figure out for so long what that brings up in me as this stress response, because boredom is some people's dream.
Mm.
They'd love to just have nothing on their mind and just kind of sit still and in the sun and read a book or whatever it is. And I'm slowly learning to really, really enjoy those things. But it took me so long to try and figure that out, and I still haven't figured it out. But I do think it might be connected to when I was a kid and I would spend time alone in my room. It was usually as a result of some sort of episode of not doing something right, or either a response from my parents around, oh no, you shouldn't be doing that, go sit in your room, you shouldn't be mean to your brother, whatever. Or it might be a self-induced flagellation around, you didn't do well enough on your maths exam, it's so incredibly disappointing, take myself to my room, go sit there. But as a young person, I didn't learn. I know I touched on my mum trying to teach me how to process my emotions, but I often think as parents, it's really hard to watch your kids process emotions as well. So a lot of the time it's hurried. It's like, okay, well, I see you crying, but I don't want to see you crying. Mm-hmm. I want you to feel better. So let's go to the shops and get some ice cream. And so I don't think, and it's also something that probably wasn't in the parenting books either back then. So I don't think I ever learnt to sit with my emotions or to process my emotions. And so for me, I associate sitting alone in my room doing nothing, because I didn't have my phone back then. It didn't exist. I associate that with this fear of my feelings and this fear of my own mind. And for some reason, it just feels like a really scary place. But I think when you learn, or you start to learn how to tackle negative emotions and you start to tackle processing negative feelings, you can kind of live your life not in fear of those feelings or emotions. You can learn to process them and face them on your own, sitting in a room, and then it just doesn't become so scary. But I find myself all the time, if I'm feeling really low, I will go straight to Instagram or TikTok. a mixture of self-validation, like I might post something on there, or I'll just scroll and see what other people are up to, or send memes to people and facilitate some sort of peer-to-peer connection. It's a mixture of all of those things. So I think there's a lot of pulling us to our phones and our favorite apps, but I also think there's a lot of avoiding going on as well, because we don't have the capacity to be bored anymore.
No, we don't. And I wonder if there's something to be learned with sitting in boredom. Mm. And I would imagine so, given that what will come up is whatever you've been pushing to the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, with noise, with apps. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, even though that sucks, so you'd say, well, just leave it at the bottom. Just keep distracting, right? The problem is that you can't outrun feelings. As I tried, and there's not enough distractions in the world. Like I got probably 20 years
wow.
before it caught up. Yeah. But I do believe that one day it will catch you if you don't stop now and learn to face the music of whatever you don't want to feel.
Yeah. And I also think it's really shitty to have to live your life avoiding your feelings, because that means you're avoiding certain situations, certain people, certain jobs that could potentially make you happy. And so
having, and grow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. By avoiding that discomfort, you're also discounting yourself all of these amazing experiences as well. And it also means that something else is controlling your life and you're not in control of your life.
Not in control of your life. Yeah, I don't know if a lot of people feel in control of their life.
No. I think it's extremely difficult to get to the point of feeling like you're past all of that discomfort.
How do you feel in control of your life? What do you do?
I think I genuinely feel quite in control of my life. And I don't know if this is healthy control or not, because I think at some point you have to learn to let go of things. And I think that piece you were describing before borrows a lot from letting go. But I think I'm at a period in my life where I don't hold a lot of power. Just as an example, I recently, on Monday this week, got kicked out of my apartment by Meriton, these
arseholes.
Conglomerate, yeah, landlords, arseholes, yeah. And I felt so much lack of power and inferiority, and I was just so frustrated at how little I felt and how small I felt. And so at this point in my life, I don't have huge resources to fight situations like this that come up. My only choice now is, for my basic survival, is to find other shelter. And I don't have the resources to go purchase a home or to move into something around the corner. I have to kind of dig a little deeper and it takes a little more time. So I definitely feel like there's a lot of my life, given my maybe age and the fact that I don't have a ton of resources yet, like financially, the people, I don't have a partner yet. But there is a lot in my life that I do feel control over, and that would probably be what I do for a living.
Mm.
And I think that kind of gives me some power back, because like I said, I can live where I want. I can travel if I want. I can show up to my desk whenever I want, or not at all if I don't want to.
I think that's a really powerful thing, because we're all guilty of architecting our life in a certain way based on really core needs. Like, you know, we started the whole interview with freedom, you know, and family.
Mm.
So we go along and we make conscious decisions to try and accommodate our needs.
Mm.
And then sometimes, well, most of the time, needs require sacrifice. You need to trade stuff off in order to hit something. Mm. So you've consciously traded a bunch of stuff off to make sure that you're free, close to family, and I would say closely followed by a want to be in service.
Yep.
You've created a charity, you've devoted your life to this,
mm.
and you've become an entrepreneur, a very fucking tough journey, in order to get those needs met.
Yep.
Now, the consequence of that is that some of the other more traditional needs, such as the financial security and the finding a partner, etc.,
yep.
one side of you might internally be like, look at this, you failed, you don't have power here. But there's this other side of you that you've been listening to this whole time because it has been saying you have to hit these needs because they're so important.
More important.
Yeah. Mm. And I think it's a sequencing thing. And in these moments and crossroads, we have a choice, right? To look like, oh, I failed because I don't have this, or oh, I've succeeded because I got my core needs met.
Yeah.
And those needs that are obviously secondary because I've designed my life like this will be met. I just need to do them next, you know.
Exactly.
That's not to diminish or say that an experience that you had with your asshole landlord wouldn't make you feel powerless in those moments. But I hope that from an outsider's perspective, you can look in and see what I see, which is a very intentional choice to end up maybe not exactly here, but pretty fucking close.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I would agree.
Yeah. Mm. I think a lot of life is a story, you know, and it's a story that we get to choose. I don't think anxiety and depression is a choice that, you know, if someone asked me, would you have chosen to go through a living hell for 2 decades? I would have said no. But no on thanks. The other side of it, I do think that the quality of our life is more of a choice than we believe.
Yeah.
You know, outside of genetics, there's a fuck ton of option in the way that we choose to view our experiences.
Yeah.
And what is a story that in really hard moments you tell yourself to help bring you back to a positive mindset? What's a lens that you put on the camera?
Probably the fact that a lot of what happens to us isn't our fault. Obviously the negative things that happen, but also the success as well. I think there's a level of, you know, privilege that we have to acknowledge as part of that success. And then it's almost like a baseline for success. If you're here in this really kind of equitable position that's already, when you're born, a lot further than so many people in life, then success is further in reach for you. But I do think it's our responsibility, say if something negative did happen to us when we were younger, or when we had less resources, or we were less in charge of our own decisions and we had to trust other people to make them for us. I do, however, think it's our responsibility to move past them and look at ourselves and seek support as well. I think obviously that straddles a very fine line of how mental illness can really debilitate those decisions for us. But I do think it's been comforting for me to know that there is a lot of life that happens to us, but there is a lot of life that we can make happen for us, and a lot of decisions that mean that we do still have power and we can move past stuff and we can make changes and we can make choices and we can grow and we can end up in situations that are as a result of our own choices, that are our fault.
Yeah. Being in a position of power is feeling powerful, not being in a position of power, because that implies that someone needs to be less than, but it is important. And I feel most powerful when I feel most loved. You know, there are moments when I could have no resources, but so much, no resources in the material sense, but just people around me being like, hey, you fucking rock. And I'll be like, I do fucking rock, you know, I am powerful and I can do it. And it's taken me a shit ton of time to trust my wings and not the branch. Right. And the more and more I've learned to trust my wings, the more powerful I feel, because I'm like, I mean, not to this extent just yet, but I'm like, you know what, life, fucking throw it at me. I fucking dare you. Like, I can and will get through this.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few things that still could break me. Probably the main thing left is, like, if my mum died right now, I'd be fucked.
I'm the same.
I'd be institutionalized.
Yeah, don't even start. We'd be done.
But it's less about then what is losing her. It's why would that affect me so much? What does that represent? And what it represents to me is the final stage of trusting my wings. Because I think for a long time, she was my wings.
Yeah.
There is no way in the world I was trusting my feathers.
Yeah.
In fact, I would have paid someone to pluck my feathers off. And she kind of held them up. And then over time as an adult, I'm like, okay, I think I can fucking do this. And then I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. Now I'm helping others do it.
Mm.
But still there's almost this belief that just one step away is a 33-year-old man independently being involved with five businesses and standing on stage in front of thousands of people. The reality is at any point in time, just an inch away, I believe that there is a mother bird with a feather on her on my back.
Yeah.
You know, being like, it's okay.
Yeah.
And when I need to download that so far into my system that when she is actually no longer here, I still feel that supported.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually that feather on the back that I feel that is her becomes me.
Mm.
Fully me that I depend on myself. Mm. Is that something you relate to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think an example of that would be my life this week. Like, it was an absolute catastrophe on Monday. They also gave us 2 weeks and 3 days notice.
I have a personal vendetta against whoever Millie's tenants is. Landlord, sorry.
A lot of people do. Meriton sucks. They don't care though.
Saying that on camera.
That's fine.
No, we're intentionally doing it. Just making sure they know.
Yeah. So everything fell apart and it was awful and it was scary. And the first person I called was my mum because she already had the backstory and that was the final straw. And I almost look forward to calling her in moments like that because I know that she'll feel for me as well. So I'm not on my own. I don't have to process emotions on my own in those situations. She's there also taking on some of that emotional load, which I don't know if is super healthy. But she's holding it with me. Yeah, exactly. And so I was really, really upset. I really love where I live. And obviously 2.5 weeks is not a lot of time logistically. But I knew as soon as I got that email, and I was absolutely shattered, that I trusted myself and my brain and my ability to solve problems and to move past challenges and to get shit done enough that I knew that I would be okay. And at lunchtime today, we secured a new place and application approved and we're all done. Like, it's all over before close of business Friday, which is just how I operate. You know what I mean? Like, the wing on the back is my mom, who I call up when I'm like, can you believe this? Let's process this together because it's so shitty. But at the same time, we both know, her and I both know, that I have the ability and the capacity to get it sorted. And that also, I mean, goes without saying, requires a level of privilege to get things sorted like that. And it also depends on the situation, because there's a lot of things in life where you can't sort them out. Mm. You can't just make something happen by the end of the week. And they're a lot harder to deal with. I always find that the antithesis to my anxiety is action. And if I'm able to deploy an action plan really clearly, if I can apply for properties, I can go to inspections, I can do that, I'll already feel a ton better because I'm actually doing something to try and get closer to my ideal outcome and further away from this hopelessness and this lack of power.
Action, right?
Yeah.
Action really does. The moment we just get a little hint of momentum, it's just the spark we need to start snowballing.
Mm.
And I think that's the hard part about depression is that the spark plug just does not fucking fire.
No, exactly.
And you're just praying for some type of progress and we kind of just loop on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there's a million things I could talk about here, but I guess I want to ask you, what's a spark plug you use when you're depressed?
I usually try and, I guess, reevaluate my life, like have a bit of an existential crisis, like, what am I actually doing? Go back to the core of me as a human being. Like, I've got some data now. I've lived a ton of different places and I've done a bunch of random things and I've known a lot of people, and I will continue to do so. But I would say that I do have enough data now to look back and go, when was a time that I felt really myself? When did I feel at peace? When did I feel surrounded by people that mattered to me? What was I doing when I felt most happy? All of those kinds of things. And so I'll, again, get great, I guess, satisfaction around those action items that fall around rejigging my life.
Yep.
And that could easily fall into the unhealthy trap of avoidance, where when I broke up with this partner and we ended things early last year, my immediate kind of action plan was to, okay, I'm going to move interstate. I'm going to get a rescue dog. I'm going to create a new community where I live. I might even work for someone else. Like, I was just thinking really kind of, I guess, big picture, because the little things don't do it for you when you're just feeling so hopeless. It's kind of like, even the things that I used to love most, like going for a walk and getting coffee with my friend, or seeing my family's dogs, or even spending time with my mom, they don't do it for you anymore, which is why it feels so scary and yeah. You feel so extremely low. For me, I had to think big picture. It's like, how can I restart? Mm. How can I shock myself out of this state so hard that I have a new chance? I have this new start and I can kind of reinvent myself beyond this depression, because I don't want it to just completely consume me and my identity. I know that I can be more than this. And so I think also that includes a lot of lifestyle changes as well, because a lot of my depression, although I have this kind of baseline hereditary depression, a lot of that time was situational depression, because I was making choices that weren't aligned with where I wanted to be or how I wanted to live, and it made me feel so, so shit. So, you know, I got back on antidepressants. I got in the queue for online therapy. I ended a relationship. I got a rescue dog. I decided to move interstate. And I was on this journey with my therapist. We were kind of in person and online. It was still kind of COVID, but I have clear notes on my phone of that first session. It was over 6 months, where I hadn't even ended my relationship and I'd only just gotten back on antidepressants. And it was like a full circle moment where I was then living in Sydney with my dog. And it was worlds apart. And we were kind of like, all right, well, I think you're going to be all right for a little while. It's kind of like, this is a really nice place to leave it. Mm. And I was like, holy shit, I think you're right. Like,
I think I fucking climbed a mountain.
It's, you get to the peak, I guess, and you look back and you're like, oh my God, you don't realize how low you are until you're looking back from the top of that hole.
Yeah, fully. Another analogy I like to use is sometimes the progress feels so slow. Mm. It's like being in a boat without a motor. And you're like, I'm not fucking moving. But 6 months later, you look back and the island's like in the distance. You're like, holy shit, I've done stuff. How good.
Yeah.
And that is a moment that we have to take stock of. And I love the fact that you take the time to go back and read through your notes and your journal and stuff, because we need to leave ourselves a paper trail sometimes to remind ourselves who we were and who we are, so that we don't get cognitively distorted by thinking we are exactly where we used to be, because it's just not fucking true.
Exactly. And I have to always remember that when I go through these peaks and troughs. Like, I find it quite cyclical as someone who gets a period, but also just through the seasons of life. Like, I have these really lovely periods where I feel at peace and everything feels like it's going right. And I think that kind of energy that I bring attracts more good things. And then, magnetic. You know, something, you become magnetic for a little while. And then something happens to you that kind of shakes you a little bit. And then you kind of go through that confirmation bias of, oh, maybe life isn't actually that good. Maybe it was only just a fluke that I had these past few months. But I swear, every single time I go through this process, I forget that it's cyclical. I forget that it's seasonal. Mm. I forget that nothing lasts forever. Everything is temporary. So I have to just remember in those times where, probably like a few days before I get my period, for example, everything is, I'm catatonic. Mm. It's all over. I'm just, you know, the worst version of me, and everything feels so heavy and I feel so upset. But I know that it's only temporary. And even beyond physiology, if for example, this week, at the start of this week, I was catatonic as well. I was like, I have to leave a place that I really love. This is my neighborhood. All of that stuff. But I mean, it's going to be fine. So I just have to remember that it's temporary. And I can't remember who, but it's probably quite a widely used technique. Where you write yourself a letter from your highest self to your lowest self, and you go, I'm at my peak right now. I'm at one of my peaks. You're going to definitely experience a trough again. So here's a letter just to remind you that you will get out of it. It's only temporary. Mm. Everything is going to be fine. So just chill. Just go through it. Go through the motions. Feel the feelings. Process the emotions. And just know that you're going to come out the other side. Mm. And I think that's also helpful for the good times as well, because they're not permanent either. They're fleeting. They're temporary. Obviously, you can operate at this baseline of peace and happiness and enjoyment and gratitude, and all of that is something that I aim for all the time. And I think my troughs have slowly started to get less deep and less low. But you've also got to remember that the highs are really special as well, and they're not permanent either.
Yeah, to just exhale and look around when they're there, right? Yeah. And nature will show us that the leaves will grow, the leaves will fall, and that will repeat for the rest of eternity. Just like, you know, reason, season, lifetime, people come in, people go, and emotions will do the same. Mm-hmm. And I think the lighter we can hold things and just kind of just let them be experiences, either moments of joy or moments of growth, and not fight against what is. Again, to beat this analogy to death, but trust your wings and not the branch.
I love that one though. That's a good one.
Right? Someone told me that, I don't know, and I was like, holy fuck, that defines resilience in the most poetic way ever.
Yeah.
And like self-trust.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And internalizing capability as opposed to externalizing chance.
Yeah.
So as we walk this home, what is a question that you wish I'd asked you but I didn't?
Probably what my preventative strategies are.
Hit me.
To facilitate mental health. Mine have changed a lot over that 18 months that I've been on the upwards climb out of that hole. And so I would say that exercise or movement has become top of the list for me. I think that also encapsulates a lot of other smaller habits, like being outdoors, getting up early as well. Mm. And they are all byproducts of the movement that I choose to do every day and the time of day that I choose to do them.
Mm-hmm.
Just little things like getting up earlier help with my energy levels, which then helps with my productivity, which helps with my self-worth. It helps me go to sleep at night. It helps my anxiety. There's just all of these flow-on effects from really kind of accessible lifestyle changes.
Mm.
Obviously, I have the resources to be able to afford medication, which is amazing. And that forms part of my preventative plan as well. But I would argue that we all need to be thinking preventatively, no matter what our previous mental health journey looks like. If we've got the capacity now where we're facing stability and this baseline level, it's probably a good time to look at what you can do to help prevent ending up in crisis mode again. Because once you're in crisis mode, you've got nothing unless you've prepared for it like a literal storm. You don't have the energy to reach for the right things. You go inwards. You don't go outwards. So by looking at, okay, what am I doing that I can build into my routine to not just help prevent myself getting back into that crisis mode, but to also know what to do and who to reach for when I eventually get back there at some point in life when I hit a really rough patch.
So to that point, what's the best piece of advice you've been given about your mental health, or advice that you've made yourself that you would put on a billboard for people to drive past every day?
Oh my God, one thing?
Yeah, one thing.
Oh my God, that's so tricky because mental health is so subjective.
I know. But what comes to your gut? Because you told me you've got a good gut.
Probably around the idea that connection and connectedness with others is everything. There's been, you know, a ton of research and a ton of concepts around the idea of connectedness. And I know we all experienced the lack of that during COVID and that really affected us. But I think beyond those conversations, we've kind of forgotten that pretty much one of the core reasons for living and one of the core parts of our pyramid of self and our hierarchy of needs is our connectedness with others. And that has always been the case since the beginning of time. And I don't think we are all getting enough of that, or we value it highly enough. So I think if you kind of do one thing preventatively, and even reactively for your mental health and the mental health of others, it would be to value connectedness and to spend your resources on that. If it's just saying hi to your barista or reaching out to your friend once a week, put it in your diary, like do a mass kind of check-in if you need to, whatever it is, just make sure that you're maintaining that connectedness with the world. And then even better, if you can start building this little community around where you live and operate and go to work, that's even better.
Connection is everything. Yeah. I agree. And you are devoting your life to it, as am I.
Yeah.
And how can people connect with you online?
Probably Instagram is the best place. It's kind of feeds out to everything else at Millie Rose Bannister. And
let's just say that once more so it comes through the mic real quick.
At Millie Rose Bannister, Millie with a Y.
There we go.
But also follow we... go to...
Yes, I want to do this. This is so good. Can you stare down the camera like an anchor? Go to...
No, but seriously, our charity Instagram, our Gen Z P2P Mental Health Instagram, we put out at least one or two resources every week.
Yeah,
it's literally
awesome.
Just a graphic carousel, so, or it's an interview. It. Yeah, with a creator. And that comes from our youth board. Like, what so are you going through at the moment? What do you feel like you're talking about with your friends or seeing on social media that's topical and relevant to you and your mates at the moment? And then we build out resources based on evidence-based research. And so those resources are really helpful, but it's also just, I guess, a nice place to find other people who value that type of content and connection and conversations around mental health. And I find that our community is really compassionate. Like what we were touching on at the start, I think Gen Z is a really special gen because they're so emotionally intelligent, and they're so probably because they have access to so much information and they're able to kind of self-identify a lot sooner than we were able to when we were that age, which is good and bad. So All Kind is A-L-L-K-N-D, no I in All Kind. But you could go to allkind.org or All Kind on Instagram, and yeah, join our community.
It is very cool content, and I also love the design of it. I think you've done a lot of thinking around making sure that what you're doing resonates with the audience and how they want to hear it.
Yeah.
So it's also a good resource for parents to send to their kids, I think, to be able to stay connected and an online world, given the conversation we had before. If people are going to be on their screens, then let's give them content that will help them grow.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining me, Millie.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.